Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is Rachel Houser Hall, one of my favorite writers and author of What Never Happened. She is a New York Times bestselling author of We Lie Here, These Toxic Things, and Now She's Gone. And They All Fall Down. And with James Patterson, The Good Sister. She is a Los Angeles Times Book Prize finalist, as well as an International Thriller Writers Award nominee. And Rachel, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me back. I am so happy to see you and that your podcast still exists. This is great to be back.
Thank you. So the novel is set in Avalon on Catalina Island, California. Yeah. Never heard of Avalon, heard of Catalina Island. Uh-huh. And I wondered why you set your novel there. So I looked up Catalina Island online, and this is mm-hmm. what I found. The heading is Discover Catalina Island. Are you looking for a little adventure? Maybe you'd like to spend a relaxing day with family at the beach, or perhaps you're planning the first visit to the island. No matter what your interests are, Catalina Island has something for you. So it's clearly a destination place for the privileged, slightly privileged, to go on vacation. And I would imagine that you saw this as a great source of conflict between the locals, the long-established families, and the newbies.
Yeah. I mean, for those of you who don't know, the town on Catalina is called Avalon. So there's that. But I wanted to write a story. You know, I love LA stories. And Catalina is actually a part of Los Angeles County. And it's a part of the school district. So, and it's 26 miles away by boat. And so it's a part of LA, but it's not. It's the place that we all went to on field trips as, you know, LA kids and outdoor education, those type of things. And then when you're dating in your 20s, you go over and have a date day, you hold hands, you get, you know, saltwater taffy. You know, it's one of those kind of romantic places. But me being a crime writer, I knew that there was something bubbling beneath this kind of perfect, pristine, fun, come over and live your best life type of thing vibe that it has. And, you know, when I did a real tour, I kind of found that yes, Catalina has its issues. And so it's like, well, I want to put a crime story here. Of this place that is Los Angeles, but not. So yeah, that's one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to write this story on that island.
So your protagonist, Colette Coco Weber or Weber?
Weber.
Weber. Mm-hmm. Sole survivor of a family that was murdered in Avalon on the island of Catalina. Yeah. When she was about 16, and by pure luck, she snuck out of the house and she came back to her family being murdered. You have given this character such trauma. Not only did her family get murdered, she is a journalist, wanted mm-hmm. to be a journalist, but she's an obituary writer.
Yeah.
And I think all of us hate Micah. We all hate her husband, Micah.
Her husband, yeah. I, you know, we tend to watch a lot of true crime documentaries, right? And they're always survivors. There's always family. And you really don't get their story once, you know, the episode ends, either the crook or murderer is caught or not caught, and credits. It's like, well, what happens to those families who have experienced the worst thing that they could possibly experience? So I wanted to study that. I wanted to give her a writing career because I like writing careers, but I wanted her also to have a career that spoke to what happened to her. And that was, you know, the death of her family. And so she is an obituary writer, but not just any obituary writer. She's one of those writers who make the obituaries like just elegant and beautiful and very personal, not rote, not born dead, whatever, you know, those kind of typical ones that you read. She wants to honor, you know, the person who's lost and the family. I also wanted to talk about isolation. Not only is Catalina as a place isolated from Los Angeles, she emotionally is isolated because her family's gone. Her aunt has taken care of her, but doesn't really like her. And her husband, who she's looking for connection, but can't trust connection for many reasons. She's emotionally isolated from him. So that's one of the biggest themes of this story, which is, you know, you can't run from your problems. And also, what does it feel to be isolated in every way you can?
So I'm going to ask this, and I know you won't answer it. Is Micah based on somebody you know in real life?
No, but the situation with the, I won't spoil it, but the situation that their relationship is based on someone I know.
When you were writing Micah, did you realize how much your readers are can't find any redeeming quality? I'm like, is there a little bit to kind of sort of like, oh, Micah, he's chasing
he's
the cash.
I mean,
nothing there.
Other than that, I mean, it's more on the other side, not necessarily people I know like Micah. I know women like Colette who are looking for any kind of connection to anybody. They don't want to be alone either because of economics, because of fear, because that's what I'm supposed to do. And so they get with these guys who are just, they're awful people. And you're like, well, why are you with this person? It's like, oh, well, he loves me, or we have kids together, or thousands of different experiences and excuses that they make. So yeah, she is connected to this guy because, one, of course, there was an attraction there, but she thought she could have a life with him. She thought she could change him, maybe. She thought maybe he would go away and she wouldn't have to deal with it. So, you know, it's one of those complications that you find yourself in where you're thinking it's going to work out and it doesn't, and you don't know what to do and it's blowing up. And so, yeah, that's that's her. And we know a lot of people who fall for that all the time.
So the murders happened in the novel June 23rd, 2001. You published your first novel in 2002.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And 2001 has a lot of significance historically. We had 9/11 happen. Was there any reason why you said it in 2001, or am I just looking at something that I've sort of made connections in my own mind?
Yes, definitely. Because of that tragedy of 9/11. So that was a huge, huge national tragedy for the world, for America. But that tragedy for Coco and her family, they're far removed from New York. So while it's awful, they're way over here, literally, you know, as far as you can get away in America, well, on the lower 48, away from New York. And so that's a big tragedy. But for Colette, this tragedy with just her family, that's the tragedy that changed her life, that changed her trajectory, that has made her who she is, not 9/11. So yeah, I chose that time because I wanted to, yes, 9/11, but this is worse for her than those planes. So that's why.
So the plot is spun out over 13 days, mm-hmm. basically, outside of the flashbacks.
Yes.
And each chapter starts with a date, which in my mind builds up anticipation and sort of this intensity on top of the action itself. Just seeing that date, March 9th, 2020. Talk about, as a novelist, as a thriller writer, how important you think it is to sort of use a simple thing like a chapter date to sort of drive tension.
Well, I chose that date for a reason. And as a writer, you have to think about time and context and history, what's going on there, and how is that setting going to affect your character? Because settings do. And if we all remember, early March 2020, what was happening then, the ultimate isolation event, the start of COVID-19.
And that, you beat, I'm going to have to say this. I want the audience to know I was going to get to COVID. She beat me to it. That week, it was literally that week we shut down on my job. It was literally that week.
Mm-hmm.
But so, by the way, I didn't
about catch isolation, that. Right?
Yes.
Here she is, isolated. And then on top of that, the most isolated experience in the 21st century, probably in the 20th, you know, is happening at the same time. And she's stuck on this island that has a history that killed her family. And she can't get back to LA because they're not running the ferries back and forth because of COVID. So isolation upon isolation. You know, as a writer, you want to put your characters through their paces. You want to have it get worse and worse and worse and worse. Because for me, you know, life is like that, where you go through this season of just despair and you're exhausted. And it's like, what else can happen? And then that thing happens and on and on and on. So I wanted to build on the sense of isolation, the fear that we were all feeling, and how we thought, oh, it's just going to be 2 weeks. And it ended up being longer than that. Her holding her breath, literally because of COVID, and also to figure out what happened to the people that she loved. COVID. Yeah, I definitely chose that time for that reason, just to amp up the whole kind of haunted suspense thing that we were all feeling. We knew nothing about what was about to happen. We just saw, you know, people dying and masks and new words. I mean, who thought of PPE? We had never said that word. And so, yeah, I wanted this new world for Colette while she's trying to figure out the old world.
Now, you wouldn't have happened to start writing this novel on March 9th, 2020.
No, but I did start it in 2021. So it was still for the most part, shut down in some ways. And we just had access to vaccines in that February of 2021. And so I wanted to, when I was writing the story, I knew that I wanted to write, you know, a COVID story. And I started with these toxic things at the very end, because even though, you know, even though it's tragic, as crime writers and crime writers who are responsible enough to try and make their work as real and as relevant as possible, I wanted that setting. I wanted to, what I was feeling, I wanted to put on this story, because I didn't know as a writer, I didn't know what was going on. My day job, you know, I'm a medical writer at Cedars-Sinai. So I'm writing all these things that, you know, I don't know anything about this, and I'm learning too. And I'm doing it at home, where I was, you know, I never worked at home for my day job, and now I am, and it's affecting my other writing. So I, as a creative, as a day jobber, I was messed up in that way. And so I wanted to take advantage of that shifting foundation that I was experiencing and put it on these characters who are going through a lot.
So I mentioned earlier, you published your first book in 2002. Mm-hmm. You started writing this book in 2021.
Yeah. And my first book was actually published on the first anniversary of 9/11. So September 11, 2002, which is awful. It was awful.
So how has your writing changed? How has your process changed? Looking back to 2000, because I'm assuming you started writing your first book probably in 1999, 2000.
Yeah. For one, I have figured out what my voice was. Back then in 1999, I was, 29 years old. Very impressionable, wanting to write the great American novel, wanting to be on the Granta list of 30 under 30. and write important things, right? Capital I, capital T, important things. And so I didn't know who I was as a writer, but I knew that I wanted to be like, you know, contemporary Toni Morrison, that kind of thing. And so I was trying to imitate that in some ways, but the story that I ended up telling, A Quiet Storm, while it was considered literary fiction, there were suspense elements in it. And I got closer over the years. I got closer and closer and closer. That's what I wanted to write. I didn't realize that's what I wanted to write until I was there with Land of Shadows. So that shifted for me. Also living, you know, when you're 29, you're hopeful. You don't know much. And the 30s is nothing but one life experience after another, one thing, you grow up. And so my writing, I believe, got richer because I was experiencing all angst and anxiety and the highs of, you know, buying your house and having your kid and the realities of, you know, layoffs and sickness and your parents getting older. So my writing started reflecting all that. I started learning and I found that the older you are, the richer your writing is. You have more context, you have more reality. I remember writing stories with moms and their kids before I had a kid. And I look back at it now, it's like, oh, she'd never do that. She's a mom. I mean, it reminds me of Steven Spielberg said when he wrote Close Encounters of the Third Kind, how Richard Dreyfuss goes into the spaceship at the very end. He wrote that before he had kids. And he said, you know, after he had kids, Richard Dreyfuss, that character would not have left Earth to go with aliens because he'd never leave his kids. So, you know, just that thing changes who you are as a creative. So yeah, I got older, things started happening to me. I became a mother and a new type of fear settled within me. You know, one that threatened my daughter. So I had a lot to grab onto, more so than when I started A Quiet Storm.
So do writers, new writers, do they, in your mind, mm-hmm. is it hard to think that what you write, even if it's fiction, is really going to be reflected in part based on your experiences in addition to your hopes and your dreams?
I hope it does. For me, all my writing is very personal. Even if it hasn't happened to me, you know, directly in real life, like the murder of my family, that has never happened. I know family dramatics and people who resent you and your role in your family, all this stuff that I felt I put into my stories of being a Black woman. Most of my stories are about Black women in spaces that, do we belong there or do we not? And we're there alone. How are we feeling? I put that angst and anxiety into my stories. So yeah, I think the best stories, especially crime stories, have some of the author's experience and fears and anger and trying to figure things out yourself in real life. I think that makes a story richer. For me, I get up at 4:30, as you know, every morning to write. And for me to do that every day, except for Christmas, I need to care about that thing that I'm writing. And so the way I care about that thing I'm writing, I write about things that worry me. So yes, family, safety, belonging, toxic relationships, I've done it all, right? And so, and now it goes into my writing. It's like free therapy.
One of my favorite characters, Gwen.
I love Gwen.
She is. She's my favorite because she reminds me of relatives or people
yes.
I know.
Yes.
That saltiness, that intra-family conflict.
Even, you know, people of a certain age remember the smell of Vienna sausages in that boiled can with the on the stove and the yellow mustard. You remember that, and you remember, you know, your grandma, your mom watching Edge of Night And then Donahue, you know, it brings back all these memories of women like that and this kind of visceral feeling. I've gotten a lot. Oh, so many people have said they loved Gwen, but they loved her the moment I said Vienna sausages, because it immediately took them back to that couch.
I try to forget the Vienna sausages, you know, and the spam.
Spam. Fried spam and bologna.
Yes, bologna. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you do bring that back to us, just for some of us, at least, who remember, you know, you have that aunt who doesn't get along with the rest of the family there. Because Gwen just, you know, she's like, she probably thinks her brother was a little snooty.
Bougie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is that person who also secretly kind of has those aspirations, but she hasn't hit that apex of her existence. And, you know, she's actually pretty interesting. We all have those family members who are kind of like on the edges of things. And she is definitely on the edges of things. She's a thief.
I like her love life, too. Yeah. She's got a little, she has some interesting love life there.
She is a fully realized older woman. And I wanted to write about that, too. That, you know, as you get older, you know, less ads target you as a woman. You're not considered sexy. You know, the men are marrying younger women. And so I wanted to talk about relevancy and being a woman in this story, which is, you know, part of the murder thing. But I also wanted to say that just because you're old, you don't die. You know, sometimes a few years ago, or maybe last year, it was nursing homes who had like this huge uptick of gonorrhea or something like that. And it's like nursing homes. It's like, yeah, they're getting it in the nursing home in Leisure World. And that's, you know, sad, but that's interesting because they haven't stopped living. And I wanted Gwen to, as Auntie Mame says, live. And she definitely does.
I love the way
I based her one on family members, but also the real life. I think her name is Doris Roberts. She was the black jewel thief who like stole jewelry from all around the world. And they finally caught her. She was 80, I think, years old, and they caught her. And she went to jail for a little while. And then when she got out, she went to a jewelry store and stole some more stuff. And it's like, well, that's kind of badass. Here's this old black lady who seduced men, all this stuff, had all this incredible life, stealing jewelry. It's like, that's crazy. That's interesting. Yeah, it's against the law, but I want to know her story. So yeah, that Gwen was also based on her.
So we could have a remake, a TV show set early in the life of Gwen, mm-hmm. a female version of It Takes a Thief.
Uh-huh. Starring Diane Carroll.
Oh God. I remember Julia so much.
Yes, right? Right. I mean, from Julia to
Claudine. She was on Dynasty.
Dynasty, yes. Whole range. She could do it. She could do it.
So I do want to talk about Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness of Coco, because she actually has a happy at last plan. So part of the theme of this is her pursuing her happiness.
Yeah.
Really just not giving up on trying to pursue her happiness despite all the trauma.
Yeah.
And tragedy that she's experienced. Talk about building such a resilient character.
She gets it from her father. Her father's optimism that it's going to be okay, that everything's going to work out. And that helped lead to their demise. But she chooses to believe it, because if she doesn't, then there's not much for her. You know, she has to hold on to this one kernel of optimism, which means also holding on to her father, which also means going through it and looking for the best thing, even though the best thing isn't happening and trying to think the best of people, even though they're showing you their ass. She's just really hoping that there's more. And that's why she wants to run away from the reality that sometimes there's not more, to this place where I'm going to get my house back. It's torn down right now, but I'm going to build it up and it's going to be great. Gwen and I are going to be happy together. I have to have this. I have to have this, because if I don't, I'm just going to lose it and lose myself and, you know, just cease to exist. So yeah, I wanted her to be this reluctant optimist for her sake, for her sanity in some ways, for her to be comfortable enough to reconcile what happened. I mean, the day that her family, when they were killed, she complained about them being boring. You know, she was kind of resentful of them, her parents not letting her live. And she wanted drama in her life, and she got it. And that's what happens sometimes when you pray a specific prayer. You get that thing of, now you have drama. Now you have this exciting life. Now you are someone that people are intrigued about. And she feels that guilt, but she knows that she can work it out. If she remains as optimistic as she can, she will be forgiven for that prayer. Does that make sense?
It does. And I, the other thing, it just reminds me of her struggles of just going way back to some classical literature like Candide by Rousseau, in terms of just this people who have just suffered. Yeah. If you go back to Job in the Bible, people who have just suffered and, you know, in the case of Job, surviving the suffering.
Yeah. No, and for Job, my husband and I always talk about this story. You know, the Job story, I always heard the happy ending was he got a new wife and kids and more cattle. And I'm like, well, his wife died. What about her? What about those dead kids? That's not happy for them. Maybe happy for that guy, but how is that a happy ending? So yeah, I wanted that, because I got, in some ways I find that ridiculous. And that's why when we started this conversation, the families of those who are left behind after their people are slain, there is no happily ever after. Sure, he may have been caught, the guy who did it, but there's this large empty shell that's no longer there. Your Christmases are different. Everything's different. This is not a happy ending. So Colette knows that, but she wants it to be as close as it can be, and she won't get there if she's constantly looking for doom and gloom.
You introduced her best friend, Maddie, as someone who's hired her to work for the local newspaper. Maddie comes from a family with money, long established in Avalon. They were best friends in college at UCLA. However, are they really frenemies? Because there is some level of competition, and the level of friendship isn't really reciprocated.
Their relationship is the embodied question that I have. Can white women and black women really be friends, really be best friends? I don't know. Because a lot of times white women want to be the main character in every story. And I wanted to write that, how, you know, the appropriation, the dismissing of your fears as a black woman, dismissing, oh, that's not a racist thing. All that kind of back and forth that we have as women and as women of different colors, and then women with different economics and origin stories. That's the question that I pose. And for Colette, one, I think they are frenemies, because Maddie has screwed her in the past. And she is very reluctant to get close to anyone, really, because the people that she was the closest to are gone. And so it's kind of like wanting to avoid a curse. You know, I get attached to someone and God's going to take it away. You get attached to that person, God's going to take it away. So she's battling with the whole race thing, with the reluctance to put someone else that she may love in danger. Because at this point, she kind of feels like she's bad luck.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if they are definitely frenemies. Could they ever be best friends, removing that competitiveness? Is there ever a time when we're not competing against each other as women? I don't know.
I do want, I just saw a line I just wanted to repeat because I love the comparisons here. And it's talking about how slow things move on the island as opposed to in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And you write, life moves slower here. Just me walking proves that. If the island were music, Avalon would be Jimmy Buffett to LA's Guns N' Roses, Perry Como versus Post Malone. Now, some people may be surprised that I know who Post Malone is. My age. But all the young people know who Post Malone is. And maybe the young people will say, who's Perry Como? Who's Jimmy Buffett? Right?
Uh-huh.
They may say Jimmy Buffet.
Buffet, yes, right? No. And that's, L.A. is chaos, wonderful chaos, because Guns N' Roses is wonderful chaos for people of a certain age. Post Malone is wonderful chaos, as opposed to this very kind of ordered yacht rock Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville, the perfect white experience, and Perry Como, the great America that everybody wants to get back to, except some of us. That's what that island is. And for, an Angelino walking anywhere, that's crazy. We don't do that. And they don't, you can have a car, but it's a 26-year waiting list to get a car over there. So everyone is driving golf carts for the most part. If there is a car, that means that person has lived on this island long enough to be off that waiting list. So it is really slower because golf carts are slow. You get there by walking. Walking is slow as opposed to the zip and zag and noise of the city that she actually loved, the city that she probably, if she's me, feels safer in some ways, because quiet, dark spaces hide things, hide the bad guys, hide villains and ghouls. And look what happened. We're here on this island that is supposed to be safe, and the worst thing happens. He'd still be alive if we live in Los Angeles. So, they are totally different in some ways. And historically, there are not many Black people living full-time on Catalina Island. And there's a reason for that. When William Wrigley, as a Wrigley chewing gum, Wrigley Field, White Sox, when he bought the island, he wanted a certain milieu on that island. And that did not include Black folks. And fortunately, back then for him, Black people couldn't get on that ferry to cross from Los Angeles to Catalina. So if you can't get there, you can't settle there. And that was fine. So the Perry Como, the Jimmy Buffett, once again, feeds into that that dream that the original owner, not the people who actually live there, the tribes, but the owner of that island, getting back to what he wanted. He liked sweet jazz, Glenn Miller, white boys playing jazz, as opposed to Black wag your ass blast jazz. So that is a nod to the heritage of that place.
Reminds me a bit. I one of my favorite writers, David Halberstam, wrote a book called The 50s. And I didn't read the book, just sort of the summary in general. It was a nostalgic look at the 50s. And I said, that's a white man's look.
Yeah.
That's not a Black person's view of the 1950s.
No. And that's, and so when people are like, oh, the golden age, it's like, the golden age for who? Oh, it's so safe. Safe for who? You won't catch many of us doing that Route 66 drive through all of America. Because why? It's the same reason why there's a Green Book. Every space isn't safe for us. And I was fascinated. Once again, it's belonging, right? And that's one, again, the theme that I wanted. Do I belong here? And I tell the story. It's a brief passage that I actually fought to keep in this book. about the tour guide leading a tour, and the little boy spits out a tangerine seed in the dirt. And the tour guide picks it up, puts it in a napkin, and then throws it away. And I was told that story on one of my tours. And that's because if an orange tree happened to grow on that island, it would probably kill everything else. It's not an endemic plant. It needs a lot of water, orange trees. There's no water on Catalina Island. So citrus does not belong on that island. When Colette first gets to the house, she sees these overgrown plants, and she wants this handyman to cut all this down because it's nightshade, as in deadly nightshade. And he does not want to because it belongs there. I mean, the nightshade, that's actually the plant on the book. The nightshade belongs there more than Colette does. That's, once again, her not belonging somewhere, and her almost kind of wedging herself in a place that she shouldn't be in some ways.
I was looking or thinking about a lot of the crime fiction authors I've interviewed, mm-hmm. who have set their novels in the Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles area. You, Ivy Pakoda, Steph Cha, Walter Mosley, Gary Phillips, Joe Eday. And I said, what is it about the Los Angeles metro area that you think makes it such a fertile ground for the setting of crime novels?
Because there's so much ground. There are so many neighborhoods there that are a part of Los Angeles, the city, not even the county. In the city, there's 4 million people. That's a lot of stories. I mean, everyone is here. There's, you know, the largest populations outside of Armenia. We have the most Armenians, Jewish people, the most outside of Israel. You know, we have everybody here, and everybody has a different story. Every block, from block to block, has a different culture, has a different way of doing things. And it's spread out over all this land, and it's connected by freeways, and it's not a walkable city because it wasn't meant to be. And that means there are lots of places where bodies can hide, where you can store things that you don't want people to find. We were the bank robbery capital of the world because there were so many highways to get away from. So it's Los Angeles in itself. It just lends it because it's so big. It's so diverse. People come here to find themselves. People come here to act like what they think Los Angeles is. So you have posers. You don't know who's really who because you're faking it. You're talking like this, but you're from Indiana. So there's that. You can't trust people, and you can't trust their intentions or their opinions because they're not natives, versus us natives who have a whole different outlook on the city. I think that's rich. And the names that you just named, we all are writing about places that aren't necessarily the ones that you see on TV, Santa Monica and Calabasas and Beverly Hills. No, Steph is writing about, Koreatown in South LA. And Walter's writing about Central Avenue, which is totally, in a different place, but the same kind of vibe than where I live. It's a big city, and it can handle anything you throw at it. And I think that's our superpower. We get to place our stories in so many different types of places with so many different types of people. Nowhere in the world's like that.
Do you ever think about the legacy of the hard-boiled legacy of Raymond Chandler? Because now we're telling all these different stories, which has brought just taking his legacy, which toward the end was racist.
Yeah, yeah.
And misogynistic.
Yeah. But if you're a mystery writer, especially a mystery writer in Los Angeles, you have to read him. Because he all those things, yes, racist, misogynist, he was doing something that the East Coast wasn't doing, and that was making LA this sexy, dangerous place with someone who was on the outside, and the dames, and they were dangerous. It was this whole style of noir and Hollywood and the bad things that happen. You have to read Raymond Chandler more so than Dashiell Hammett for me. because Dashiell Hammett's San Francisco, but Raymond Chandler, he helped bring Los Angeles to the forefront as its own character, away from, you know, New York, away from San Francisco, all these old places to L.A. And yeah, he's an awful person in some ways, but he did that thing. And, you know, he ended up writing a lot of the stories, TV stories that we all grew up on. So there is a reason why Raymond Chandler is relevant even till today.
Last question. Mm-hmm. What are you currently reading? Any authors you want to talk about or you want to share with our listeners that they really should read?
Yes, I am currently reading All Sinners Bleed by Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby. I have on my bookshelf Ivy's new book, Sing Her Down, and I am going to read The World We Make, N.K. Jemisin, because I am publishing my first fantasy novel of a series in February. And my comp titles are, you know, N.K. Jemisin meets The Witcher, smashed together. So I'm reading more of hers.
Why the move into fantasy? Was this something you've been thinking about a long time?
No. My agent always comes to me with these incredible opportunities. And this was an opportunity where she's like, Entangled Publishing, they will be launching this new imprint, Red Tower Books, and they want these kind of high concept fantasy or romantasy, which is romance, fantasy, sci-fi, YA. And are you interested in maybe writing a series? And, you know, I don't ever want to say no to things, especially something like this, which may, one, I'll learn, and two, will bring in more readers. You know, I always want more and more and more. And so it was opportunity and not wanting to pass up something that could change my life. Wow. So that's why.
Rachel Housel Hall, author of What Never Happened. I really enjoy this book. Always love having you on Diverse Voices Book Review. Thank you so much for being on the show.
And thank you for inviting me. I look forward to seeing you next year, talking about the next book. Books.
I can't wait to interview you about your first fantasy or speculative fiction, science fiction, that whole romantic mashup. Looking forward to it.
Yes, so different from crime. So I'm looking forward to talking about it with you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.